Welcome back to the show, Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast. Welcome back to the show, Luke.
Welcome. I am so pumped for the podcast today.
You won't believe the emails. You won't believe the emails I got. You know, people predicting your untimely death.
Are you serious?
No, I'm just kidding.
At least they're thinking about me, you know?
Yeah.
At least
I hope you got everything.
Yeah.
I hope you got everything taken care of because, you know, the show really sucks without you.
Yeah. No. I just wanted to sit out the Civil War because I was protesting some of your policies on this podcast.
I was just thinking about replacing you, and then I realized I can't do it by myself. But
cool. Yeah. Yeah, no, Alan is a harsh and brutal taskmaster when it comes to podcasting, and he's really an individual you wouldn't want to know personally, so.
Yeah, well.
Jokes. These are all jokes.
I always think that I'm the face of the podcast. You're the brain, so, I mean, you know. It's a match made in heaven.
I like to think of myself as the brain, the heart, and the balls, you know, all wrapped into one.
obviously, on the last couple episodes, if you tuned in, we covered the Spanish War, so we're moving on to Pompey's return, triumph, and consulship in this episode.
Yes, absolutely. He spent about 5 years in Spain. Getting a thorough schooling in the arts of war. And now he's ready to go back, and pit his wits against the best that Rome has to offer in the political arena. And it's going to be interesting to see how, this whole thing unfolds. So, I mean, obviously, you know, when we're talking about, Sulla's return, we can't get around the fact that there were massive slave revolts in Rome, going on at this time. You know, normally the slaves were pretty docile. They were pretty, caste ridden, but what had happened with the rapid expansion, in Rome is that, a lot of slaves that had been brought in, a lot of the Teutons and Cimbri from the Marian era, they had been slaves for about 30 years now, and a lot of them had been trying to get home, trying to get back out of Rome. There's a lot of Thracians, a lot of people from the Balkan areas. And so a lot of these were very skilled, highly skilled warriors that they tried to just force into slavery, and it was having some serious consequences. At the tail end of the Spanish War, one of the things that was going on in Rome is there's this increasing threat of slaves, of these slave revolts, and there's also some conflicts with Mithridates in the East. Mithridates had came back to power, and he was lurking in the background. One of Sulla's commanders, Lucullus, had received the command to go deal with Mithridates, who was causing some problems around Bithynia. And the pirates were actually... The pirates were especially a problem because after the Punic War with Carthage, there was no more massive naval power to check pirates. And so... there started to become almost a brotherhood of piracy that was simply terrorizing the trade throughout the Mediterranean. So you had a lot of these things going on all at the same time that Pompey and Metellus Pius were trying this pretty aggressive campaign in Spain against Sertorius and his general Perperna. You have do you want to add anything? Or?
So I think that by the end of the Spanish Wars, Pompey the Great is questionably the most powerful member of the Roman Republic. In the field right now, we do have Lucullus in command in the east against Mithridates, and we also do have a certain M. Antonius, who's the grandfather of the villain Mark Antony, who we'll be talking about, commanding a pretty good force against the pirate scourge in the Mediterranean. But also I wanted to take a minute before we get into it to talk about the political scene now in Rome and during the time that Pompey was gone. And I think that very clearly we see a continued corrosion of the Solon constitution. And during Pompey's absence, the powers that were holding the Solon constitution together were clearly weakened, and movements to restore the power of the tribunes had grown. Early blows between 77 and 76 BC by Julius Caesar, who unsuccessfully prosecuted Cornelius Dolabella and Antonius Hybrida, both were Solon supporters. And in 76 BC, the tribune Sicinius attempted to restore the tribune powers. Unfortunately, he was killed for his efforts. But clearly, the Solon constitution continues to fall apart, and there is a popular outcry to restore the powers of the tribunes that Sulla had abolished in his reforms. Oh, and in 75 BC, there was a corn shortage in Rome, which we think is mostly due to the armies that were in the field, and it forced the consul C. Aurelius Cotta to compromise and carry a law to alter or to carry a law that would allow the tribunes to take further office, which was of course barred by the Solon reforms.
I believe that, you know, these this change in how long the military was spending on these foreign campaigns really kind of shows you the shift in military and political development from the time of Marius and the Marian reforms to the time of the Spanish War. Because before, the Romans would assemble, once a year. The men would be called to fight. They would go out and fight. They would return home that same year to plant the crops and what have you. But now that they were fighting in Africa, Spain, the Balkans, elsewhere, there was no more of that returning home. And there was a corporate body of officers. There were long training sessions. You had veterans that were serving years and years and years, and they were developing careers now, and they were trying to advance along this new hierarchy that was set up inside the Roman military system. And so it was its own political apparatus. So if you were to be a general like Pompey, who really had no, really, if we look at Pompey, his entire career was just a military service. He had very little experience in the politics in Rome. But what he had is an extraordinary amount of experience with inside the corporate politics of the Roman military.
Oh, yeah. So the question is, where does Pompey stand in all this on his return from Spain?
Right. So I think before we can really talk about Pompey's return, obviously, we had Perperna and his, we had Pompey burn the letters of Sertorius that indicated anyone who might have been a traitor to Rome. because obviously Sertorius had a large number of supporters within Rome, a large number of senators, and apparently these letters were pretty damning. So when he returned, it was in the midst of, it was almost as if the Senate feared that he would come back and rekindle the civil war, and almost lead to a similar Solon-type prescriptions. So that's what the Senate was thinking. Also, we had this large number of slaves, particularly at Capua. There was a large outbreak of gladiators at a training school, and led by the famous Spartacus, who was a Thracian mercenary who actually once served for the in the Roman military, but deserted to become a highwayman. And he was later captured and sold into a gladiator school. But he ended up organizing a small, and I would put that organizing in quotes, because of what I've read of Spartacus, he was really kind of a mythologized figure. There was a number of different leaders, and they really weren't organized. He was one of the leaders, but they really weren't organized as a traditional army would be. It was more of a kind of a loose association of different slaves that were revolting. I mean, there's not really an organized revolt. Anyway.
My impression is that even though Spartacus won some victories, even against some praetors, I don't think the Senate really took the servile insurrection as seriously as perhaps it deserved. And there's probably some pretty good reasoning behind that, despite the popular show Spartacus.
Right. And I mean, a lot of the other slaves that were with him were, a lot of the Teutons and Cimbri that had been captured during the invasion of the Teutons and Cimbri that we touched on, who Marius had captured and sold into slaves. So a lot of these guys had previous military experience fighting Roman soldiers under perhaps one of Rome's greatest generals. I mean, I think that's probably why they were so effective. Not only that, but they had lived in Italy for 30 some years and were training as experienced gladiators. I mean, that's the kind of insanity that Rome was under. You know, they were taking their enemies, bringing them into the heart of their country and training them to fight for decades, and then expecting, you know, not to have any problems is, a little facetious, I think. But that was the insanity that was Rome. So they, you know, as you said, they had the Senate end up sending Claudius Glaber to deal with these upstarts in Capua. Obviously, they underestimated Spartacus and the slaves, and they defeated Claudius Glaber. And then the next praetor they sent was Varinius, who was unsuccessful, and then they end up sending a praetor Caucinius to aid Varinius, and Spartacus defeated both of them and captured their camp, and that's when Spartacus famously dressed himself as a praetor and made 100 or 400 or so Roman captives fight to the death for the amusement of his slaves. If you ever see the Spartacus movie with Kirk Douglas, I think he steps in and says, "No, we shouldn't fight these people." Yeah, that's a bunch of goofiness. So basically, they started fighting around. You know, they were all from Sicily. They were fighting around the southern foot of Sicily. They ended up going up to the Alps, and they ended up fighting all the way through, almost all the way to the Alps, where they believed they could have escaped without any real opposition from the Romans. I believe the Romans even have two of the consuls, if I'm not correct, face off with Spartacus, and Spartacus destroys a double consular army. You know, these slaves. Rome doesn't know what to do because Spartacus ends up turning around. He doesn't go over the Alps, and Rome is scared to death that the slaves are going to march on Rome and burn it to the ground. So Crassus steps to the forefront and offers to raid 6 own legions at his own expense, on the condition that he is appointed to the supreme command of the war, with the rank of proconsul, which is actually the same rank that Pompey held as a governor in Spain. Crassus at this point was wanting to, you know, he had developed a political and financial web by funding a lot of the senators' rise to power. He had bought cheaply a lot of the properties the Senate had left after they were murdered by Sulla. And so, he had resold those to the senators that had been put to power. So Crassus was in fact, he had a lot of money, and he was giving out these loans, and developing an extensive network of, senatorial clients, within Rome. So he had the political clout. He had no military experience. I mean, we saw him do a little bit during the Civil War, but really he was a second fiddle to Pompey, who was the true claim to fame when it came to military arts at this time. And so Crassus goes out. He ends up cornering Spartacus in the very tip of the boot. He ends up building a 35-mile-long wall and just waits to starve him out. And the Senate starts getting nervous about this, and they send letters to Pompey and Lucullus, who's fighting Mithridates, asking them to return home because they were so afraid of this slave menace, which had to have upset Crassus, because Crassus was obviously wanting to take all of the credit for himself in doing this. We're told that Spartacus had tried to arrange some ships to pick up his troops and take them back to Sicily, where he could rekindle the Servile War. These merchants had betrayed him, and so he ends up trying to make a break for it. And Crassus ends up cutting down the majority of his troops. Pompey arrives just in the nick of time. There's probably 5,000 or so scattered troops. Pompey marches with celerity to the south and destroys these 5,000 troops, and then writes immediately to the Senate that Crassus had engaged in pitched battle, but it was really him that finished all the slaves, and he returned home, and they prepared for the triumph. Pompey was getting a triumph for his victories in Spain, and Crassus was only getting an Octavia with a laurel honor for his service, because that was the highest honor that could be bestowed on someone who achieved a victory over mere slaves. The difference was Pompey was able to ride in a chariot while Crassus had to walk on foot.
Wrapping up the Servile War, we did discuss the political situation that was Rome, and I wanted to take a second before we get into the consulship of Pompey and Crassus. Is where does Pompey stand in this political mix? Now, if we remember, Pompey did put down the Lepidus Revolution, but it's clear that he could sympathize with some of Lepidus's aims. And while Pompey was still finishing up the war in Spain, he must have been thinking about what position he was going to secure in Rome and how he was going to secure it. And Pompey had hitherto rose to be the most powerful man in the Roman world in the last 10 years. Arguably, we still have Lucullus in the field, of course, who might rival that idea. And Pompey's success was largely based on the Solon connection he had. And there were signs that connection was no longer going to suffice to secure his ends. And this is in spite of the fact that he did have a strong alliance with the Metelli, but he was still not accepted by the hardcore optimists. Men like Q. Catulus and the brothers M. Lucullus, L. Lucullus, and the order Q. Hortensius. And we'll see the trend of these people, of these main optimate leaders never fully accepting Pompey. That's something he's going to have to contend with throughout his career. There was a more moderate movement for reform, which would openly welcome Pompey and the knights. Pompey's first objective, like you said, would be to secure the consulship for himself, and he clearly had his eyes on more military prospects. However, everyone in the Senate was basically still trying to decide what they wanted to do with Pompey. I did want to mention that his supporters, L. Afranius, returned to Rome and successfully stood for the praetorship. He also had other supporters in the form of Varro and Galbinius, but at this time they weren't really big forces in the senatorial party. It seems to me that naturally Pompey was going to stay outside Rome, which he legally couldn't enter if he wanted to hold a triumph, that he had to wait for Metellus to return from Spain, who wouldn't be returning until later that year. So Pompey did have, in this case, legitimate circumstances to maintain his army and thus his imperium. And by the way, I wanted to mention that he was still, he was still 10 years too young to be consul, and legally only people of Praetorian rank and higher could even hold a triumph. But I don't think we should be opposed to the idea, though I think that Pompey legitimately held his army outside the city given these circumstances. I don't think that he would be opposed to keeping his army together to secure his ends, even if it was a bluff, because he had used this exact same tactic in 77. And when Pompey does return to Rome, I think he enjoyed that he was at the absolute height of his popularity.
Yeah, and he, you know, I don't think he was trying to intimidate anyone with those, with his troops. But I do believe he was, almost waiting for Metellus till he felt like it was safe, because he did have, I mean, he had letters, from, a lot of Sertorius's supporters within the Senate. And it is possible that there were people who might try to assassinate him, and I think keeping his troops around was more of a safeguard for himself until Metellus Pius, who was perhaps the most powerful man in Rome, came back. And obviously, as we talked about before in earlier episodes, Metellus Pius had indoctrinated Pompey into the Metelli family.
Crassus clearly had aspirations for public office in the Senate, and he was able to put aside his jealous and resentful vacillations. I wanted to use that word all week, aside, and was able to form some sort of an alliance with Pompey. Wherein Crassus would add his wealth, his rhetoric, his influence, most importantly, his influence with the Senate, which was one of the main factors, which was one of the main components that Pompey frankly lacked. Moreover, both of these men had armies at their backs, and it was enough to outweigh any political rivalry. So both generals reach Rome with an armed force. And of course, the return of Sulla was remembered, and the Senate, if not for that reason only, had acquiesced, and they were willing to ignore the legal restrictions, which technically barred Pompey for office, and the two men were elected consuls in 70 BC, and Pompey came on the top of the poll, and he was therefore the senior consul, and both were elected in absentia. And I was reading in Plutarch actually this morning, and he tells us that, according to Plutarch, he suggests that Crassus wanted to stand together because Crassus didn't have the confidence to seek office without riding on the back of Pompey's popularity. And I was thinking that this kind of seems unlikely, as both men saw a means to pretty unlikely. Crassus had already served as praetor. He was immensely wealthy. He had just got done with a pretty respectable victory, and I would think have every reason to think that he would be elected consul without Pompey. I don't know if you wanted to weigh in on that. So I'm kind of calling BS on Plutarch saying that.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we could see Pompey's doing a lot of political maneuvering even before he stands for consulship. The previous consuls, Gellius Publica and Cornelius Lentulus Clodianus, passed a law that granted citizenship that Pompey made in Spain. And Pompey also he gave a lot of the distinguished individuals in Spain Roman citizenship, which is a pretty big deal. And he also set up a trophy in the Pyrenees, and he wisely omitted Sertorius from any of the images during his triumph, because he was getting support on all sides. I don't think it's safe to say both Pompey and Crassus could have achieved their consulship independent of each other, for sure.
And though it does seem that they put aside their differences to achieve at least one objective together, I think it's on pretty good authority that they were really biting their teeth to keep the reconciliation together, because by all accounts, Crassus deeply resented Pompey, maybe for stealing his glory, rightfully so, that's, questionable. But there is a lot of resentment there, which we'll see throughout both these men's careers, and they will have a continued political rivalry, though they're both going to be serving as consul at the same time twice in their career. And it's interesting that no description of Pompey's consulship survives, but we know that it was probably at the end of December, at the end of 71, and Pompey and Crassus became consuls in 70, obviously. And it would have been Pompey's duty as senior consul to chair the senatorial meeting at the first of the year in January. Even though Pompey had never in his whole life attended a senatorial meeting as whatsoever, let alone as a leading magistrate. And the ancient sources told us that his scholarly friend Varro provided him with a handbook of senatorial proceedings. His father was consul, but I don't think that he would have gotten any experience from that, because if you remember, when Strabo was consul, he spent almost the entirety of that office in the field fighting during the social war. As consul, Pompey would be responsible for proposing laws, first to the Senate and then to the Legislative Assembly. And I think it's interesting here that we get a lot of accounts of Pompey's bumbling politic and his incompetence as a speaker and a politician, but we don't get any stories here of him making any mistakes politically or with the day-to-day of the office. And I think that again supports the idea that Pompey did have some rhetorical ability or some political wit, which is often disputed.
Right. I don't think he was a impotent politician, as he's often characterized as. He really promised three things that he would take care of during his consulship. Number one, he proposed to restore the power to the tribunes. Another, he's going to take care of the matters of who controls the courts and also the provincial government. Yeah, so obviously there's a large problem with a lot of corruption within the provincial governments. And also, you know, the courts had been tug-of-war through the, between the equites and the senatorial class back and forth quite a bit. So obviously, Pompey wanted to restore, a lot of that power to the equites, and I think this speaks to a lot of who he was dealing with, because he was out having wars. The equites were the tax farmers, and they were also the people that were able to supply the troops with all their food, all their equipment. And so he had developed extremely good relationships with these business entities. So I think his political...
I think it's fun that Crassus later brags that, you can't claim to be wealthy unless you could supply a legion out of your own pocket. But I wanted to ask you, do you think that these reforms that Pompey and Crassus... despite Plutarch saying that there was bitter rivalry between them, their joint consulship is going to have some lasting effects on the history of the late Republic. But do you think that these reforms were legitimate forms on Pompey's part, or do you think it was just a power grab?
On Pompey's part?
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
do you think it was just a populist power grab, or do you think they were legitimate?
Well, I definitely think, Pompey needed all the popular support he could. He also needed all the support from the equites he could. And because that's really where his power lied. We have to realize Pompey was not legally able to hold the position that he was currently holding. He was there only because of the popular will. So, he was extremely well liked by everyone. He was looked at almost like a savior of Rome and someone that they could make exceptions for.
And popularly, he was just like this young, handsome, rock star.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about the first,
sure.
Reform?
I think, the only reform in which Pompey and Crassus actually collaborated during their entire consulship was to restore the legislative power to the tribunes. The Senate really offered no objections reform is generally accepted. Also Crassus had, as I talked about previously, had developed an extremely intricate web of financial and political favors within the senatorial class. Both Pompey and Crassus could definitely expect a profit from the tribute legislation. I don't think any of them would see really where that restoration of that tribune's power would lead to in the future.
We also see some support. I wanted to mention we also have a little bit of senatorial support, and at the time, a pretty insignificant politician named Julius Caesar, who did speak out in support of the bill. And I didn't mean to interrupt you again, but you're right. I mean, it was hugely popular and wasn't met with a lot of resistance.
Yeah, and as far as the restoration of the courts, the matter of the senatorial juries, I think we need to look at the trial of Verres, in which I think Cicero plays a major part. Cicero, in fact, speaks several times in the Veronese as though the threat which the Senate was facing with control of the juries was not merely the sharing of the courts, but a total transfer to the equites. So this is a really important case. I'm not sure if we've spoken about it before, but basically what happens is there's a very corrupt Sicilian governor, I believe this is the first full case that Cicero is prosecuting someone. I believe Cicero had some cases where he defended people before, but I think this is the first one in which Cicero was actually prosecuting someone for the state. So, obviously this was in Pompey's interest to have the, although we don't have an active hand of Pompey's and Charleveres, he obviously was probably blessing this and maybe giving support behind the scenes. We don't know.
I think that he definitely thought it was a blessing. I mean, because elected that year 70 was Hortensius and someone else. What was his name of the Metelli clan? And speaking out against Verres for Pompey probably wasn't very politically bright, but.
Right, and Hortensius.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. The other council, the Caecilius Metellus, was the other consul who was elected in 70, and he was going to take up a governorship. We think in Sicily. So he would have, the Metelli didn't want to see governors prosecuted in this way. I think there were four Metellus's coming in the office this year, and they naturally expected a lucrative career as governors in the following year. And they had no interest in seeing these governors prosecuted. And I think another important aspect of this Verres prosecution was it helped emphasize the need for reform, because this particular measure was pretty hotly resisted by the optimist parties. And Hortensius, who was elected consul in the summer of 70, was Verres' main advocate.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe the trial was in August or later in the year sometime. I think this was a feather in his cap at the end of his consulship. We see at the beginning during Pompey's consulship. So we've already talked about the reforms giving power back to the tribunes, and we talked about his blessing Cicero's prosecution of Verres, which restored the courts to the equites. But also, I think we need to look at his popularity in relation to Crassus too. We're told the absolute zenith of his power is when the Romans are taking the previous the censors are taking the census of the equites, and there's almost a promenade of the knights of Rome coming with their horses, and then the Roman Republic either stands and boos and hisses at people as they give accounts of their service to Rome over the past year, or they cheer them. And we're told that Pompey enters into the forum, leading his horse from the front, surrounded by 12 lictors who make a path through the crowd of people, and he approaches the censors, and there's a dramatic pause, and which he says, I am Pompey, and I've served under my own under myself and under my own imperatore. So the crowd goes wild, and they end up shutting down the forum for the day, and everyone just parties in the streets and just celebrates, Pompey's, basically self-aggrandizement. It's almost like a second, triumph or something.
And I do like the, I don't want to call it the restoration necessarily. But when you talk about that, they reinstituted the censors in 70 BC. And, I think it was also pretty significant because we have census figures from 85, which reflect a population of almost half a million people. 463,000 people. And in 69, that census rises to 900,000 people. You know, granted, you have a 15-year period there of population growth, but you know, I don't think the census counted for women and children as probably vote eligible voters. But either way, with the restoration of the censors, they were able to fully enfranchise the new citizens, which we talked about in the social wars. And these citizens can now participate in the legislative process, and which was of course a popular measure. And these voters would weigh heavily in Pompey's favor,
at least at the beginning. I mean, we see Crassus though. He ends up throwing a feast in which over 1,000 tables are set up throughout the streets of Rome, and maybe even 10,000, and he ends up throwing a feast for the whole city. You also see him basically purchase and give away free grain to all the citizens of Rome. So although Pompey may have been popular, Crassus had the funds and the political clout to just wine and dine the entire population of Rome for, you know, months at a time. So there was obviously some contention. As the consulship of Crassus and Pompey wind down to a close, they were almost not even speaking to each other because of their rivalry. We're told that as they're sitting in session one day, a young squire from the country speaks up and says he had a dream from Jupiter that told him that ill would befall Rome if the two consuls left their consulship without reconciling their differences. In which case, Crassus extends his hand and says something to the effect of, for those of you who you have chosen to call the great even before he had hair on his face, you know, I extend my hand in friendship, or something like that. And they shook hands, so there was a formal truce between the two. And I think that probably assured Crassus that there was at least a formality, and that Pompey was not going to, attempt to militarily dominate Rome. You know, because that had to have been what Crassus was most afraid of.
And it's interesting that at the close of their consulship, obviously Pompey has his eyes on extraordinary command, but he more or less disappears from public view for about 3 years, but neither he nor Crassus take up a command or a provincial governorship immediately after their consulships. And another advantage of the restoration of the censors that I forgot to mention was the censors were able to remove senators from office. Supposedly there were qualifications to be a senator, and they can be removed if they don't meet these qualifications on those grounds. But obviously this is a pretty significant political tool. And these first, these new censors, this Gaius Poplicula, and Cornelius Lentulus, were Pompeian sympathizers. And undoubtedly they were awarded for their loyal service to Pompey, but the censors had with them the power to remove senators from office, and this is a pretty significant political tool here.
Right, and I think I'm going to read a quote here, which kind of makes an observation of how of the difference between the political animal that Pompey was as a political war animal within the corporation of the Roman military, versus the sort of style of politics that occurred in the Senate. Life in the robes of peace has a dangerous tendency to diminish the reputation of those whom war has made great and ill-suited to democratic equality. Such men claim the precedence in the city which they held in the field, while those who achieve less distinction in the field feel it intolerable if in the city, at any rate, they have no advantage. Therefore, when the people find a man active in the forum, who has shown in the camps and triumphs, they depress and humiliate him. But when he renounces and withdraws from such activity, they preserve his military reputation and authority untouched by their envy. So there's definitely a division between the honors that would be given to a military man of Rome, a military general, and a prominent politician. You know, I think before this time, before Marius, we wouldn't have seen a division between the two. If you were a prominent general, you would have been a prominent politician. There would have been no difference. And I think we're starting to see even Pompey break away from the Metelli family with the trial of Verres, as you talked about, Alan. I think we're starting to see this corporate revolution now take place in Rome.
All right. The one final measure of their consulship that I did need to mention was a bill put forward by the tribune Plautius, which granted allotments of land to the Spanish veterans, the soldiers of Metellus and Pompey, and this is, of course, payment for their services. I like that you say that before Marius, all the great statesmen were soldiers. Is that basically what you said? And that's so different than the political background that's so different than the professional background we see in our modern day politicians. You know, I don't think we have a lot of, let's say ex-presidents that had an exclusive war background, except for like George Washington, you know, who was a professional soldier,
yeah,
I guess.
Eisenhower.
Oh yeah, Eisenhower.
Yeah, Eisenhower. Yeah. I think we're definitely in this period in Roman history. I think it would be easy to equate Pompey with perhaps an Eisenhower if Eisenhower was like 20 years old when he became president, you know, or like 25. You know, I think that would be kind of the equivalent, because what's the age on is it 30? You have to be 35 to be a president, or is it 45 or something? I'm not sure exactly, but it'd be an insane situation, to have, you know, a general that young and, you know, that powerful. But it's definitely interesting to see the transition between, you know, the statesman warrior and the bifurcation between the corporate, really the corporate warrior and the political beast like Crassus.
In our very first podcast, we talked about the rise of the equites, the knights, and when they're able to ally their interests with the popular party, they're almost always able to circumvent the Senate. And as a result of this consulship of 70, the consulship of Pompey and Crassus, the political climate is thrown right back into that pre-Solon atmosphere.
Right. And as we go forward, we'll start getting to Julius Caesar. Obviously, start getting more into the Menes, and eventually the conflicts that embroil the Rome in the Middle East and in the War of the Hades. So, thank you for listening to the Pompey the Great podcast and the Fall of the Roman Republic. This is Luke Murphy.
And I'm Alan Keith, and please tune in next time.